Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Mark from North Wales.
Wow. Thanks. My name is Mark. I'm an alcoholic. Hey, everybody. Does this thing sound okay? I'm not used to the whole microphone thing. All right. Well, my sobriety date is 27 October 2005. I've got a home group, the Percocet Tuesday Night Beginners Group, 7 o'clock. If you're ever in Percocet, Tuesday night, 7 o'clock, stop in. And I have a sponsor who has a sponsor, and I'm sponsoring other men at this point. And I guess I'll tell you, I was going to say a little bit, but a lot about what it was like, what happened, and got an hour to fill, so it's going to be a lot. This is only the second time I ever did the hour thing, so we'll see how that goes. But I was born outside of Philadelphia in the suburbs into a totally normal, completely dysfunctional suburban household, old house, old neighborhood, old parents, you know, both parents still there, a couple of older brothers, and just, I mean, everything was ideally suburban, you know, but inside my head I was terrified of everything all the time. For no good reason. Like, I had nothing to be afraid of. There was, you know, I was safe, I was well provided for, you know, parents loved me, all that kind of stuff, but I was always just completely terrified of everything, no matter what. Pretty much my earliest memories were of fear. And that, I mean, that fear, that terror pretty much pervaded my whole life up until about 6 years ago and change when I finally went through the 12 steps with my sponsor. You know, I did fairly well in school. You know, I did as well as I wanted to. I was one of those people who could kind of just hear stuff talked about in class and retain it and then regurgitate it on a test. So my grades looked good and I did well in the things that interested me, and the shit I didn't care about, so I didn't bother. And that's pretty much another pattern in my life. But, you know, when I got to junior high school, and this was like the early 70s, and, you know, well, let me back up a second. There was, in my household, there was always like a little bit of alcohol around. There wasn't any like mad drinking. There wasn't any like rampant alcoholism that I could really point a finger at. You know, my uncle, maybe. But, you know, it was like a normal kind of household. But there was always alcohol around. And, again, some of my earliest memories, aside from the fear, were of trying to figure out a way to get alcohol. You know, there was always, like, occasions I could have a little bit of wine, like on a family occasion or, you know, a picnic, you know, in the summer, take a sip out of somebody's beer or whatever. And I always wanted more, even though, I mean, for, you know, a lot more years, I never actually felt the effects of alcohol in me. But for some reason, it was something I always wanted. And, you know, there was something back then called paregoric, which is an alcohol and something else-based medication that I, you know, as soon as I got some of that for stomach cramps and stuff like that, I wanted more of that too. And, you know, I would lie, I would manipulate, I would do all those kind of fiendy things to, you know, talk my mother into giving me this stuff because I liked the way it made me feel. And it made me feel warm and safe and happy and, you know, all those things that I didn't feel when I was just in my own head. And, you know, I never drank a lot. I probably, you know, only got, you know, buzzed or drunk a couple of times during my teen years. But early 70s in the suburbs, it was a lot easier for a kid like me to get, you know, a lot of other things besides alcohol. And I'm not going to get specific, but, you know, so junior high school, I started picking up a couple of, you know, other forms of alcohol. And, you know, at first I was doing the whole it was what the cool kids were doing, so I wanted to do it too thing. And then I found it if I had it, I was cool, and then that whole thing set up, you know, the whole that whole culture and being a part of that. And, you know, as soon as I got involved in that, my grades really started to slip. Anything else I had interest in started to slip. And there wasn't a whole lot that, you know, I really spent time with other than, you know, hanging out with the people that did what I wanted to do. And, you know, hanging out in basements or down by the creek or, you know, stuff like that, pulling petty stuff and running from the police and, you know, just all the kids bored, all the stuff that bored suburban kids do. And that, I mean, that pattern pretty much carried through. The grades started slipping. I got into high school and, you know, my use of things started to accelerate. And, you know, by that time, it wasn't so much something that I wanted to do or that I wanted to be a part of, but it was pretty much a requirement for me, if my eyes were open, to have something in my system, because I wasn't, you know, happy in me. I wasn't capable of doing the world if I wasn't loaded. And if I wasn't loaded, I was working like hell to try and get loaded. And, you know, back then they didn't have cell phones, so there's plenty of time on pay phones and, you know, on the phone at home and, you know, why won't he answer and all that kind of stuff. So, the phenomenon of craving had already, you know, set up, and that the obsession, that mental obsession I had, you know, even when I didn't have anything in my system, was already there at that point. You know, high school was pretty much a fiasco. You know, I remember parts of it, and, you know, it wasn't all that great. I didn't have, like, one of those, you know, cool John Hughes movies kind of high school experiences. You know, I was basically, you know, a burnout that felt like crap all the time and was just wishing I was someplace else or sometime else or somebody else. But I was stuck here, there with me, and, you know, I wasn't really digging it. And I just barely scraped out of high school. Again, I could take tests well for whatever reason. And had a horrible GPA, but, you know, got out of high school and into college behind test scores. And, you know, man, when I hit college, that was like a rude awakening. So I don't think I ever really cracked a book in high school. Like I said, I could hear things, remember things, and, you know, pass tests and act like I was paying attention. So now, I think my GPA in high school is like a 0.8 or 0.9 or something, which apparently isn't all that good. But I got into a decent school, and, you know, but then, the rude awakening hit, because I had never really acquired study habits or any kind of work ethic or those things that are apparently important when you're going to a higher education kind of thing. And I think I lasted like three semesters. And, you know, it was a mess. I mean, it was a complete waste of money. And all I did was, you know, teach myself how to fail academically. And I learned how to drink beer, because this is a beer drinking kind of thing. And, you know, wasn't a real favorite of mine, but it made me feel not like me. So beer was okay at that point. And after three semesters, like, they didn't beg me to come back, and I wasn't, you know, really anxious to go back, so we just kind of parted company. And, you know, my parents did that, well, if you're not going to school, you better get a job thing. So I had some interesting jobs at that point. For a couple of months, I was a telephone salesman for Evelyn Wood Speed Reading, if any of you old heads remember that. Yeah, I was the guy on the other end of the phone when you called in that 800 number. I was the guy who would lie his ass off to you to get you to choke up your $800 to learn how to read fast. And it was a cool job, because I had my own office, you know, with a window that opened, so I could, like, hang out the window and do what I wanted to do. I got to lie, and when I lied really well, I got a bonus. So, you know, that felt pretty good. You know, I was pretty good at that, because by that time I was an accomplished liar, a thief, a vest pocket gangster at best probably. But, you know, I fancied myself a criminal mastermind. But the whole lying to people was, you know, I was good at that. And But so that gig lasted a few months, and I don't even remember what happened to that one. But then I worked in a paper mill for a while, grinding up newspaper into cellulose insulation, and that was an awesome job. And it's like as romantic as it sounds. But yeah, $2.50 an hour, and like all the cellulose you could breathe. But you know, there was a loading dock right out back, so you know, we could go back there and do whatever we wanted to do and come back in, and it made the newspapers a lot more interesting. But, you know, still to this point, I really hadn't picked up alcohol as a drug of daily use. You know, there was always plenty of other stuff around, and, you know, there was a lot of money to be made doing things with the other stuff, and there was a whole, you know, lifestyle evolving in the late 70s, early 80s about that stuff, and got pretty heavily involved in that. But, you know, as a legit job, I fell into the restaurant business. There was a place opening like a mile from my mom's house where I was living. And, you know, I started bussing tables there and really hated that. That was, you know, I would have rather been in the paper mill almost than doing the bussing tables thing. And it didn't agree with me. And I was afraid of people. I was afraid of everything, but people in particular, and like strangers out in a dining room having fun that I had to like weave in between. The whole thing just freaked me out. And, you know, as soon as I could, and I saw the guys in the kitchen, and the guys in the kitchen were like drinking and, you know, partying the way I partied, and they were like yelling and carrying on, and there was tons of excitement and like energy and adrenaline and, you know, power and stuff like that. I was like, damn, that's what I want to do. I want to be in there with those guys. And, you know, I always liked cooking, so I thought, you know, why not, you know? So I talked my way into the kitchen and, you know, started at the bottom of, you know, working dinner. So I started, like, the side station, like putting pasta in the bowl and really involved stuff like that. But, I enjoyed it. It was probably one of the first times I had ever actually felt like a part of something, you know, like the night crew. You know, we'd bitch about the day crew and bitch about management, and you know, we had a good old time. And but you know, service stopped at like 11 o'clock. We were done cleaning up by like midnight or one or so, depending on the night. And you know, then everybody would file across the street to this little bar called the Brothers 2 Ripplewood Inn on 611, if anybody's familiar. It's a really class establishment. And, you know, they'd start drinking. And, you know, I wanted to be part of the crew. So I'd have a beer or some kind of, you know, umbrella drink or whatever that I thought was cool for that week. And so I started, you know, drinking a little bit kind of on a nightly basis. And, oh, there's like waitresses there too. So the drinking made the talking to them a lot easier. And I started finding, like, a use for alcohol in my life. You know, it was something I could do while at work. I mean, there was tons of alcohol on the line. There was a couple kinds of cooking wine. I mean, there was the bartender right through the little window right there that, you know, we could trade appetizers for booze to the bartender. And there was the baker's box in the back with, you know, all kinds of liqueurs and stuff. There's plenty of booze to be stolen in there. And I was adept at stealing booze. And you know, the progression is kind of weird. There, like the progression of me in the kitchen and the alcohol in me kind of take off on the same, you know, upward slope at about the same time. And you know, I started working in the kitchen and having a beer or two or a drink after work. And within 18 months, I had like worked my way through the whole line and, you know, really excelled at it and had progressed to nighttime kitchen manager. And by that time, my drinking had progressed to the point where my normal daily regimen was at, I worked dinner. So at like 1 or 2 in the afternoon, I'd kind of shake awake, you know, starting to go through it already because it had probably been like 3 or 4 hours since I took my last drink. And I would like feel around at the bottom of the bed because I always slept with like a bottle between my feet or down by my feet so I could just kind of like haul it up in the middle of the night, take a couple hits off it and, you know, go back out for a while. And, You know, if that was empty when I woke up, it was like the mad dash out of the house, into the car, and to the state store, because I didn't have a whole lot of time before the, you know, the puking, the hair hurting, the, you know, just the horrible started. And, you know, there was a lot of days, you know, having to stop three or four times on the way to the state store and, you know, opening the door and puking and, you know, get to the state store. And I thought I was slick because I went to like four or five different state stores so they wouldn't know that I was drinking a lot. And no matter which one I pulled up to, they all had like big glass windows in the front. And by the time my hand hit the door, they had the pint of Jocklin's on the counter already, like bagged and waiting and rung up, you know. So they apparently knew something was up before I did. But, you know, and not to get real graphic, but I will, just to show you where alcohol had taken me at this point in 18 months, you know. This is where I was that, you know, inevitably I'd be sitting in the car, you know, looking around, take that first hit off the bottle, and it would always come right back up, and it would go right back into the bottle because I wasn't wasting that hit. You know, I wasn't wasting that mouthful of vodka. You know, I needed that. And that's what alcohol did to me in 18 months, from having a casual beer after work to puking in a bottle and drinking it because I needed the alcohol. So, you know, looking at that, that just absolutely convinces me that, and my earlier behavior, my fear, all that, but I was born an alcoholic. And for whatever reason, I don't know what the mechanism of that is, but I was born an alcoholic. And my disease was just waiting for me to apply enough alcohol to reach that tipping point, and then bam, I just like exploded. And for the next, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 years, I don't even, the chronology at that point doesn't mean a whole lot. But it was, you know, losing jobs, trying to get a job, you know, trying to hang out with the people who I hadn't burned too many times to let me hang out and try and steal some booze off them. You know, taking change out of parked cars, you know, stealing money from my mom and my dad and anybody else who had anything laying around. And, you know, just trying to stay loaded because, you know, at that point I didn't have the power of choice in drinking. You know, I would go through withdrawal often and, you know, spend the 3 or 4 days of shaking and puking and hair hurting and, you know, the seeing stuff in the corner of my eyes and, you know, then waking up in the morning and like the second day flopping around like a fish, you know. I found out they're seizures and they're not good for you, but I just thought that was a part of like detoxing. But, you know, I probably had 50 or 100 seizures detoxing myself. And I go, you know, after I went through all that like pain and horror and, you know, the just incredible mental anguish, the physical pain, you know, I think, oh, man, thank God that's behind me. Okay, I'm not going to drink anymore because when I drink, really terrible shit happens. And so I'll stick to that, maybe a little of that, maybe one or two of them on occasion. But the drinking, I got to put that down. That shit's going to kill me. You know, I just can't do that anymore. And, you know, inevitably, I'd last maybe a week or something, you know, doing other stuff, not having any alcohol. And for whatever reason, my car would pull into a state store. And as much as I didn't want to, I'd be buying a pint. Or it would pull into a bar, and I'd be sitting there at a bar drinking a beer going like, here I am again, you know. And I couldn't not drink. I couldn't recall with enough force, like, the pain, the fear, you know, because now the fear came with the drinking. I had more fear drinking than I did not drinking. So all the things that alcohol had originally done for me, it was taken back and replacing with just, you know, orders of magnitude worse pain. But I couldn't put any kind of dry time together. And I started seeing a psychologist, and, you know, within a couple of months, I had him, you know, saying, well, your alcohol problem's obviously beat, you know, if you want to continue to talk about life issues. No, I'm good. But every time I left that place, I would stop at the state store down the street, and I'd be drunk before I got home. So, you know, the whole the world of psychology didn't hold a solution for me. You know, and I eventually wound up in rehab. I went to rehab at Valley Forge Medical Center in around Norristown. I guess it's East Norton there. I'm not sure. But and that was 1986. So you can do the math and realize that, you know, I didn't get sober that time for good. But I went through a 26-day program there and went through detox, and it was a joy. But, you know, I thought they were going to give me, like, all kinds of great drugs and stuff to help me detox, but all they do is give you enough of something to keep you from dying. So, but the thing I remember from rehab was they said, you know, go to AA meetings. And there used to be a lounge there where you could sit and smoke. And, you know, the people who were going to AA meetings had to walk through this lounge to get into the cafeteria where the meetings were being held. And there was this one chick who came to meetings on, I think it was Thursday night, but she had on like these super tight red jeans, and she was blonde and gorgeous, and I was like, I'm going to AA. That's my kind of thing right there. You know, so, you know, I don't know if it was the red jeans that got me in there or just that was, you know, just one of God's tools, but, you know, it got me looking forward to going to meetings. And, you know, the message that I heard in that place, in that time, and with my ears, I heard, don't drink, go to meetings, and the rest is bullshit. And I was like, okay, don't drink. Yeah, I got that, because when I drink, shit gets bad. You know, go to meetings. Meetings are okay. There's, like, chicks in red jeans, and there's some pretty cool people, and there's, you know, there's a bunch of punks here, and there's guys with motorcycles, and, you know, this is okay. You know, this, I can do this. This is like a whole crowd of freaks just kind of up my alley, and I can, you know, this is better than the real world. So, you know, I'll go to meetings. And the whole, and the rest is bullshit thing worked for me because I'm inherently lazy, and if the less I got to do, the happier I am. So I could just stop there and be good. I was like, okay, I'm good. And, you know, all that being said, I mean, that message that I heard got me to a shitload of AA meetings, and for whatever reason, and I guess it's really it's God's grace, you know, I didn't pick up alcohol for, well, since that time. You know, since 1986, I haven't picked up alcohol. And I learned a lot. You know, I learned how to be friends with people. I learned how to associate, you know, in a group of people kind of all traveling in the same direction. And we had, you know, we had a lot of fun back then. There was a lot of music going on. There was, you know, there were midnight rides, we call them. There's like crazy midnight 12-step calls trying to get some cat, you know, who's like flipping out into a detox or into a rehab. And you got to take him to 9 different places to find a place that'll take him because his card hasn't come through yet and all that good shit. So, you know, the midnight rides that end in flat tires and, you know, have to go out and rescue people. And, you know, it was, we called it life on the edge, you know, me and some of the guys that, you know, I traveled around with. And it was really, it was pretty cool. You know, it was the first time I'd ever belonged to anything that was kind of moving in a positive manner. And I enjoyed it. Like I said, I learned a lot. And, you know, between God's grace and that kind of peer pressure of the fellowship, I didn't pick up a drink for, you know, a long time when I probably should have, because what I thought at that point, I thought drinking or alcohol and drugs were my problem. And when I put them down, I put down my problem, and then I was good. And what I didn't realize was that the alcohol and drugs were my solution to my problem, and my problem was in my mind and in my body, and that, you know, I was running for years without a solution to that. You know, my solution were, you know, more like Band-Aids on a sucking chest wound of, like, the fellowship and, you know, music and going to diners and going bowling and shooting pool and, you know, stuff like that. The social aspect of this thing really, really, you know, it kept me in for a long time. And, you know, there was service work. We chaired meetings and, you know, we started meetings and all kinds of stuff. And, you know, but the one thing I didn't do was work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a sponsor. I had a few sponsors. I made a couple of real shallow, cursory attempts at, like, doing the steps on the wall, you know, on the shades. And pretty much as soon as I got to the God word, I mean, it was easy for me to see that I was powerless. My life was unmanageable when I drank. I mean, that was a no-brainer. But, you know, as soon as I got to that, anything about a higher power or God, it was just like, woo. You know, I was baptized Presbyterian, I guess, and had gone to Sunday school and, you know, church when I was a little kid and all that. And I couldn't buy it. It just didn't work for me. I remember sitting in Sunday school and seeing the picture on the easel of, like, this guy in the robes with the beard and, you know, clouds and thunder in the background and stuff. And, you know, it's like, really, this guy, like, runs the universe and he makes all this shit work? And I don't think so. And it's kind of weird because I was probably like 4 or 5 at this point, but I wasn't buying it from that point. So I don't know. I guess I was born an atheist as well as an alcoholic. But, you know, like I said, as soon as I got to that point, you know, doing the steps on the wall that's, you know, mentioned higher power or God, it was just immediately full stop. You know, there's no way that I can do this God thing. I mean, I was a militant atheist. I would talk for hours on a bar stool, convincing somebody about the non-existence of God. You know, is if you needed God, you're weak. You know, you got nothing going on. You know, it's for idiots. You know, any thinking person can look at, you know, a physics book and some chemistry and some astronomy and see how this shit works. It's pretty simple. It's all equations. And, you know, I held on to that attitude for a long time. And kind of like wore that as a mantle, like that militant atheism, you know, that belligerent denial of a higher power. And, you know, it, you know, well, it is what it is. And I got where I got because of that. So, but I never worked the steps. I never found a solution. You know, I put Band-Aids on that chest wound and, you know, had a lot of fun, shot a lot of pool, you know, never learned how to bowl worth a damn, but that's okay. But, you know, after a while, you know, I moved out to the country, like away from, you know, my people. I was all like 40 minutes away, but it was like an entirely different universe where I moved. It was weird out here in the sticks. Actually, I moved not too far from here, so it's weird out here in the sticks. But, you know, that fellowship kind of fell away. I severed the ties with, you know, my casual acquaintances and some of my real, you know, some of the guys I was really tight with. You know, I maintained a kind of a casual friendship. You know, a lot of us, you know, joined a motorcycle club, and I rode with a motorcycle club for a while. And, that feeling, that, you know, sense of belonging, no matter, like, what I joined or, you know, what jacket I was wearing, it, you know, I was starting to feel less a part of. I was kind of taking that, like, gradual left into the weeds, you know. And, you know, I started going to meetings a little bit while, you know, out there. And, you know, after a while, it just became too much of a hassle. Like, I'd rather go out in the garage and fuck around with bikes, or I'd rather watch TV, or, you know, if I want to, you know. And I tell myself, if I want to go to a meeting, I'll, like, imagine in my head, like, the same people talking the same crap about the same other people. And, okay, I'm good. I'll stay home. You know, I completely missed the point of what AA meetings were about. And, you know, I don't know exactly when it was, but it was about 15 years dry, give or take. You know, I had a car accident not long after I got sober. I got rear-ended and did a lot of damage to my neck and back. And, you know, that was starting to bother me a little bit. And, you know, so I went to a doctor, and I found a very amenable doctor. And, you know, I found a couple of other ailments that required, you know, medications that I found enjoyable. And, you know, I started abusing prescription drugs, and, you know, it didn't take long for exactly the same thing to happen with them as happened with alcohol the first time, because, you know, my problem was still 100% intact. I mean, my body was still my body, and my mind was still the mind it was. And, you know, it didn't take long for that stuff to get insane, you know. And at that point, my wife was critically ill. She was gravely ill, not critically ill, but she had a lot of ailments that required a lot of fairly heavy-duty medication. And, you know, when my prescriptions ran out, I would start, you know, borrowing a little bit of hers. And, you know, when it became borrowing enough for hers that she noticed, I would, you know, start convincing her that, you know, well, you know, you're not remembering right. You're taking so much of this stuff. You don't know what's going on. You know, I'm sober. I couldn't possibly be stealing your, you know, oxys and your muscle relaxers and stuff like that. You know, it couldn't possibly be me. And, you know, for a long time I believed her, or she believed me. And for a long time, you know, I didn't want to do it. You know, I didn't want to continue to use, to steal, to lie, and I couldn't not do it. You know, I had reached that tipping point again where, you know, I had to. And I would sit there on the couch and, you know, I'd be kind of rocking inside my head like, I'm not going to do it, 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 I'm not going to do it. And as soon as she'd leave the room, bam, I'd be in the pills, shake some out, put them back, and, you know, that whole thing. And, you know, and I can, you know, I can be a fairly forceful person at times, and I can, you know, I've got some willpower in certain areas, and I had nothing. I had no defense against doing the one thing I didn't want to do. You know, 2 seconds before, I'd be, I don't want to do it, I don't want to do it, I don't want to do it, and then I'd do it. Just, it was, you know, it was nothing but insanity, and I couldn't not do it. And, you know, thank God she eventually got sick of it. She caught me and threw me out of the house. And, you know, the only place that I had to go was, you know, this guy. He had lived in the apartment over me when I got my first place after getting out of Valley Forge. He had the apartment upstairs with a couple other guys. And I moved in downstairs with a guy that I had gotten out of rehab with. And, you know, we became really, really good friends. And, you know, we were together through a lot in both of our lives. I think we were best man at each other's wedding at least once. I forget. There was a few of them thrown in there, too. But, you know, that was like the only place I could go. And I wound up sleeping on this guy's couch for, three or four months. But he was still really active in AA. And he had found a solution to his problem. And he had found it through the 12 steps. And he took me to meetings pretty much every night for, months. And, you know, kind of pointed me at some people. And, you know, there were some things that came into my head at that point. And, you know, it's not like it's my bright ideas, because my bright ideas always wind up with me, like, on the floor flopping around like a fish. But, you know, what came into my head was that maybe I've actually got to work the steps this time. You know, maybe that shit's on the wall for a reason. You know, maybe they, all these people that are looking happy and are being successful and are, like, doing life, maybe that's what they're doing. And, you know, that wasn't my thinking. That had to be, you know, again, God's grace putting stuff in my head that I couldn't come up with on my own. But I went to a lot of meetings, and, you know, I talked to a lot of people. And another thing I realized that I wanted to do, or was given to me to do, was I had to go hunt up all those old guys that, you know, I had gotten sober with the first time and, you know, tell them what had happened instead of just, like, waltzing back in the room and like, oh, Mark's back, I'm good. You know, I went to a lot of those old guys that were in this men's meeting I used to go to in Cedars and, you know, kind of pulled each one of them aside and told them, you know, like, you know, I've been out there for like 5 years, it's been fucking horrible, and I'm trying to come back in. And, you know, I was seriously waiting for, you know, some, wow, I told you so, you know, some like old guy gruff bullshit. But every one of them to a guy said, welcome back. And that really blew my mind, you know, that, you know, these old guys, and this was a weird meeting for me. I mean, it was in the basement of a church, so that was kind of weird for me to be in a church. But it was a lot of, like, old retired businessmen and, like, college professors and, like, a lot of pink shirts with the collars turned up and golfing and Volvos and, you know, completely different ilk than my normal. And those guys, you know, the first time around, they welcomed me with open arms. Me and a couple other guys used to ride up there on bikes looking like, you know, just like absolute messes. And, you know, they welcomed us then, and they welcomed me back when I came back in. And it really kind of gave me a little, you know, surge of faith in, you know, the love that sober men can show for each other. You know, it really kind of blew my mind. And in talking to some of these guys, you know, they pointed me to a guy who pointed me to a guy that was taking guys through the steps in the basement of the same church that I used to go to that men's meeting at. And I went and talked to this guy, and I said, you know, I think I want to go through the steps. I want to, like, I got to do this thing. You know, I'm not, you know, I got to do this thing right this time. And, you know, he told me, and I asked him to be my sponsor. And he said, well, do you know what that means? And I was like, well, I don't kind of think I do, but why don't you tell me? And, you know, he rolled off all the things that he wasn't going to be, you know. And, you know, it says it in the big book, you know, he wasn't going to be my banker or my, you know, boarding house or my big brother or, you know, and he wasn't going to tell me to call him every day. He wasn't going to, you know, put requirements on him. He said, if you want to go through the steps, be here every Wednesday at 7 o'clock, get a brand new big book, a pen, and a highlighter. And I was like, okay. And I showed up the next week with my brand new big book and my pen and my highlighter. And he says, and I just want to let you know that I'm a born-again Christian and my personal Savior is Jesus Christ. And I was like, oh, man. Shit. I was waiting for the sales pitch at this point. You know, I was waiting for the... And he never rolled out a sales pitch. You know, and right after he said that, he told me, no, and that's the last time I'm ever going to mention my personal beliefs because they have no bearing at all on your recovery. And I was like, oh, that's kind of unusually refreshing. He said, okay, open your big book to the first page, and at the bottom of the first page, write, find God or die. And I was like, oh, man, shit. Like, I couldn't get away from this. Like, you know, here's this freaking God thing, like, smacking me in the face like a dead fish. It's like, ugh. And, you know, and I gave him the look or something. He said, write it down. And, like, okay. You know, I had been convinced by that point that, you know, if I didn't do this thing, I was going to die. You know, I didn't have the illusion anymore that, you know, willpower was going to enable me to stop, that fear was going to be able to, you know, enable me to stop, that, you know, all this knowledge I had of the AA fellowship and of the disease, none of that shit was going to get me sober. You know, nothing I had on board at that point was going to get me sober. You know, so fortunately, you know, I had been beaten to a point of willingness. And, you know, I said, okay, and I wrote that. And I still have that in that big book over there. And, you know, I look at that and it just blows my mind that, you know, from that belligerent militant atheist I was 5 minutes before, that, you know, I was again given the grace that I could, like, write that in the front of my book. And from that point on, we started reading the book together. Well, he started reading the book to me and breaking it down. And he said, we're going to read every word of the first 164 pages because I don't know which word it is that's going to light up your head. And I was, okay. So we read literally every word in the first 164. You know, the preface, all the forewords, you know, all of it. And, you know, it was all pretty easy going up until the point where we started talking about the second step a little bit. And, you know, again, it was like, you know, here we are. I had this misconception that I was going to have to, you know, in order to believe in God with a capital G, I was going to have to, you know, somehow come to the realization that this whole system of beliefs and practices and, you know, clothing and getting a haircut and, like, not riding bikes, I thought, you know, how the hell is my head going to get from where it is right now to, like, I'm going to turn my life and my will over to God with a capital G? I just didn't see how that was possible. And, you know, we started reading We Agnostics. And, you know, he put before me a couple of propositions that are in there. You know, he asked me if I was willing to believe in a power greater than myself. And I was like, dude, I don't know. Honestly, I don't know. I can't get my head there. You know, I don't know how to say yeah to that. And he said, well, do you believe that I believe? And I said, yeah, that's pretty obvious. You know, we've talked about that. I can see you got something going on. And he said, that's good enough. Okay, the door's open. And then a little bit later on, we get to the one where, you know, either God is everything or he's nothing. And he hit me with that one. And I just kind of sat there. And I said, no, seriously, is God everything or is he nothing? You know, I want an answer. And I was like, And I knew from working with this guy for a little while that if I had said, well, God's nothing, we would have been done. He would have folded his book and gone home. And that would have been it. And so I said, okay, God's everything. Whatever. Fine. Happy. And then we read a little bit further in there. And, you know, there's that line in We Agnostics where it says, you know, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. And for whatever reason, that was the line that lit my head up. That was like, oh, man, okay. And I could see that. I could understand that. It's like, okay, like in me there's maybe a little something and everybody else. And okay, yeah, I can do that. Okay, I can see that. And that was like the very first little twinkling of some kind of spiritual, you know, awareness, a spiritual awakening in me. You know, I had had the willingness to cop to shit that I really didn't know how to cop to. But then reading that line, that was the beginning of an experience for me. And, you know, that was like that, you know, the first sight of that cornerstone. And, you know, he proceeded to take me through the rest of the book. And, you know, this belief in something kept growing in me. And, you know, I had a realization at some point that, you know, I was like baptized Presbyterian and, you know, had gone to church. And I thought that I was a Christian who, like, really sucked at it because of what I did, my behaviors, my lack of morality of, you know, of the right kind, whatever. And then I had a realization that, you know, I'm not a Christian. You know, I'm an alcoholic who's having a spiritual experience. You know, I'm not a Christian. I don't believe in a lot of that stuff. And that freed me up so immensely. You know, I had been like tethered to that, you know, I should be this, but I suck at it, and was freed up to explore, you know, a spiritual world that was just incredibly vast and incredibly generous and loving and didn't have to subscribe to any, you know, set dogma. I didn't have to memorize the book. I didn't have to, like, go buy a suit and get a haircut. You know, I could explore this thing through, you know, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and then through some other practices that I had found outside of AA. And, you know, the process of having a spiritual awakening through the 12 steps is nothing that I could ever explain, quantify. You know, there's no equations that'll really, you know, give somebody outside of this thing an understanding of what happens. And, you know, I really, at this point, I have no idea what God is. I don't have any, you know, picture. I don't have a list of magical superpowers. I don't know where he, she, it lives, you know. And I joke and I say, if somebody pressed me, I'd say that, you know, my higher power is some, like, a cross between Jerry Garcia and Joe Strummer. And that's pretty much it, you know. It's, you know, for me, God is love. And, you know, the way that I can manifest God in this world and love my fellows is through carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it's what I was given. It's what I got for whatever reason. You know, this is the thing that I was given that I can, you know, give to other people. And, you know, that paradox of through, you know, giving this thing away, we get to keep it. Again, I really can't run the numbers on something like that. But, you know, the feeling I get when, you know, either like I'm chairing a beginner's meeting, like that Percocy, my home group's a beginner's meeting. And, you know, talking about a topic and, you know, hearing people share and then watching that new guy kind of go like, oh, shit, okay, wow. That's absolutely amazing. I mean, the process of sitting down with another guy and reading the book and taking somebody through the steps and watching them kind of, you know, light up and get that spark, you know, that little bit of, you know, shine where it's all kind of like dull and grim and crappy. You know, that is just the most amazing experience in the world. And, you know what? I think I'm done. That's all I got. Thanks.